Welcome to STEM Spots, a weekly science review produced in cooperation with the Missouri State University Department of Physics, Astronomy, and Materials Science.
Hi, this is Dave Cornelison for the web version of STEM Spots. With me in the studio today is Dr. Etta Madden, a professor of English at Missouri State University and the assistant department head of the English department. Thanks for stopping by, Etta.
You're welcome. I'm always happy to talk about my work.
So we're going to talk about a particular subgenre of literature today. Give us a background of your own interest in that.
You know, I am going to give a little bit of history here. When we talked last winter, when I was lucky enough to be here on STEM Spots, we talked about very real people in the history of medicine, like Benjamin Rush. And you asked me if I might want to talk about sci-fi, and I had to say, sci-fi? I don't like sci-fi. I don't know that much about sci-fi. But then, as I got to think about it and the pandemic hit, I thought, oh, I teach utopian and dystopian literature. This is related to sci-fi. And I teach two books that have pandemics in them. Certainly that's of interest to people who listen to STEM Spots. So here I am, and I look forward to talking with you about Margaret Atwood's The Year of the Flood and, if possible, Emily St. Jean Mandel's Station 11. But maybe before we dive into those, what I should say is what the relationship between these two dystopian works is to science fiction.
Absolutely, because science fiction, many times people think of science fiction and they think space travel, craziness, time travel, whatever. They want lots and lots of science in it, especially speculative science. But this particular subgenre is a little bit different than that. Talk about that.
Sure. I think one of the best ways to get at that is to use some definitions that actually came from Atwood herself. And Ursula Le Guin, who's also known as a science fiction writer. So two of the predominant female writers in this subgenre from the late 20th century, and Le Guin has now passed away. But right after The Year of the Flood came out in 2009, Ursula Le Guin wrote a review for The Guardian. And I'm going to read from that just briefly. She said in writing, to my mind, The Handmaid's Tale, early work by Atwood, Oryx and Crake, the first work in the trilogy in which The Year of the Flood follows, and The Year of the Flood all exemplify one of the things science fiction does, which to extrapolate imaginatively from current trends and events to a near future that's half prediction, half satire. So that half prediction, half satire is crucial for Le Guin. But Atwood says that everything that happens in her novels is possible. It's no speculation. It's possible and may even have already happened, so they're not science fiction. Because science fiction is fiction in which things happen that are not possible today. So there's that unrealistic element that Margaret Atwood denied. Atwood came back in The Guardian and responded to Le Guin because she didn't agree with her. And she said, what I mean by science fiction is those books that are like H.G. Wells' The War of the Worlds. They have Martians in them. They have invasions. Those, to me, are not things that could really happen. And so she then throws out the term speculative fiction, which is much more popular today. And that emphasizes the possible, the openings, things that we might imagine could happen.
You know, that's very interesting because I was watching recently an interview of Isaac Asimov on YouTube, and he specifically talks about how he tried to, and of course Asimov is one of the greats of science fiction and wrote extensively. He talks about how he tries always to put things scientifically in his books that could be seen as possible in a future that's expanded our understanding of nature. So he had a PhD in biochemistry, and he knew a lot of science, and he also wrote some popularization books that were just scientific. So he talks about science fiction, but it still tries to keep things within the realm of the future possibilities. I like the way that Atwood's talking about this. She's being very literal in her interpretation of this. And so in that sense, dystopian and utopian. Let's talk about some of the prior examples of that and the most famous examples of that. And then let's talk a little bit about the role of Atwood and this other author.
Emily St. John Mandel.
Let's talk about both of them. So if you talk back in time about the dystopian, utopian kind of visions, talk about some of the prime examples.
So probably what people are most familiar with, at least by title, is Edward Bellamy's Looking Backward, futuristic kind of novel from the late 19th century, and then Huxley's Brave New World from 1931. So a reaction to the aftermath of World War One. One of the things that I think people are fascinated with in Brave New World is the emphasis on sexual reproduction.
Right.
Of course, Huxley is reacting to experiments in eugenics at that time. And then also the other element of that novel is the extensive drug use, the drug called Soma in the novel, which seems like a kind of opiate. Students now, readers now, are amazed by the foresight that Huxley seemed to have, but he was working with what he saw around him.
Yes, yes, I agree. 1984, of course, may be the most famous example, although many students today have not read it, and some I've met have not even heard of it. In all these cases, it seems like they're almost making, as you pointed out, political statements as much as they're making science fiction-y statements. Would you agree with
that? Yeah, that's a great point. And so 1984 emphasizes so much the control of Big Brother, the government,
right.
And Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451, you know, the burning of books and censorship and that sort of thing. And generally, dystopian literature does emphasize a society that's gone wrong, often by desires for power.
Right.
Whatever the institutions are that are in control. So that I think that that's true, that the authors are focused more on that than they are on science per se.
And all the things that they write, typically when you look at those now, you think those all probably could happen. Because a lot of it's about controlling information. There's a ton of information control in these books, and also a ton of what you want to call mass control of events, such as reproduction in the case of Brave New World, which has become something that is governed by a group of people as opposed to your own innate ability to judge, control your own reproduction
rights. And, you know, Margaret Atwood picks up on that theme in The Handmaid's Tale.
Right.
It's all
Absolutely.
About reproductive rights. And when she wrote it, that was, you know, at the forefront. There's definitely a lot about control, governmental control, corporation control in most dystopian literature.
Now, most people would probably say, when they thought of the main authors in this, except for lately, that this was male-dominated. Is there a reason for that? And is it actually true that there are plenty of female authors, but we just don't know as much about them? How does that work?
Well, I think it goes back to the issue of STEM being dominated by men for the most part.
Not biology, though.
Well, you can tell me about that, because I'm
sure.
not in the
okay.
field. But maybe then that issue is that biology has more of the life science element in it. And these two women writers that I wanted to bring up today, Atwood and Mandel, they are focusing on
That's an interesting human point.
And other species that are living. And that may be more of their emphasis than what we might think of as, you know, the physics elements, the astronomy elements that seem so strange and difficult and confusing to a lot of us that are not in the sciences.
Now, we're going to talk about Margaret Atwood quite a bit in a little bit here, but why don't we talk about this other author?
Sure. Emily St. John Mandel has actually been in Springfield twice in the last few years because of this novel, Station 11, which won the premier science fiction award, the Arthur C. Clarke Award. She won in 2015, the year after Station 11 came out. She came to talk about her book, to talk with writers who want to know about how to write this type of genre. But it, too, has a pandemic in it. The pandemic is called the Georgia flu. It is something that we're not told in detail about. Again, as in Atwood's book, we see the aftermath. We see the chaos, the results, and the divisions in society as a result of this widespread death. One of the things that's eerily prophetic about this 2014 book, maybe prompted by the swine flu, but what's eerily prophetic about it is the way in which Mandel brings up airplanes, airports, cruise ships, tankers, and the way in which a lot of citizens that are privileged in the world travel, that there's a lot of travel, and how that just causes the pandemic to just spread like wildfire. That's so much what we've experienced lately.
Sure, absolutely.
She also focuses on then the divisive results. We have a religious cult that emerges as a result of this pandemic. We have a group of people living in an airplane terminal that becomes a civilization, a museum of civilization, where items like cell phones, battery chargers, newspapers, books become these objects of the world before the pandemic, because the world becomes regressed. Technology almost goes away completely in Mendel's novel.
That sounds a little bit like some of Stephen King's work, amazingly enough, right? The Stand, some other work like that, where he has a dystopian future. Of course, he ends up getting some of the extreme nature of King's work maybe drags people away from the central theme, which is interesting to me because everything you just described sounds like the last 10 years of television, with the zombie apocalypse having The Walking Dead and other kinds of things. People just are fascinated by the world thrown into chaos. But it seems like when it's on TV, it's mostly about the crazy individualistic things that can happen to you when you have to fight off a pack of zombies. But presumably in these books, they're looking at deeper, they're trying to uncover deeper things going on here. So talk a little bit about their attempts to put a message in or put something in there.
Sure, sure. And I think film, whether it's on TV or on the big screen or watch on, you know, on your telephone, I think film is very powerful in causing people to think about the strange and the unfamiliar. When we look at a text, at a book, we often get more of the insights because we're able to go into the characters' minds, and we have that description that the narrator gives us that gives us another layer of complexity. But in any case, one of the things that actually Stephen King has written about and I share with my students is, you say, why do people read my horror books? Why do people read them? They want to be entertained, but they want to be able to see the film and walk away or read the book and set it aside and take a deep breath and say, that's not the real world. That was just that imaginary world, and I'm safe and I'm comfortable. These writers of speculative fiction or sci-fi are often pushing us to not just be entertained or think about a strange world, but to come away from that and not just say, oh, I'm glad I don't live there, but to think about the possible elements in it, those things that really could happen, and how we might respond in such a world. So one of the ways that scholars look at sci-fi is to talk about it taking us into strange worlds, just like a traveler in a foreign place. We want a map. If we have a map, we have our GPS, we feel comfortable. What if we don't have that map? How are we going to respond? And in reading science fiction, we often don't have a map because it is so strange. And so we are asked, as readers, to work really hard to understand the new land, to understand the new territory and make sense of it. And then hopefully when we come away from that, we're able to approach our own world and the changes that come up at us in a new way.
So let's talk about Margaret Atwood's book that you specifically want to talk about, Year of the Flood.
Well, it too has a pandemic in it, a waterless flood. In this case, the pandemic is caused by someone who works for the corporations who are doing all the biotech development. They're splicing genes to create new types of animals for people to eat. But one of the dissatisfied individuals releases this pathogen, which does horrible destruction to society. We don't see people that are ill. We don't see how the disease actually works. But as in Mandel's work, what we see is the aftermath. And again, we have division. The corporation, the Corsi Corps, is obviously an evil institution. Juxtaposed with that, we have God's gardeners, what many people would call a cult. I prefer to use the word commune, that are trying to live without violence, without killing animals, without killing plants if necessary. But they're raising bees, they're raising mushrooms, they're using them for medicinal purposes, they're using them for survival. And Atwood juxtaposes these two organizations, I guess you could say. But on the surface, it seems like one is bad and one is good. But in the end, she actually shows that both have their benefits and both have their problems.
Well, that's a very interesting take, because I was just going to ask you, it sort of casts the world into these very distinct questions or very distinct possibilities, one in which would be technology is always going to show us the way. I had somebody from the Brookings Institution on a few weeks ago talking about AI and the problems that could come from that. And on one hand, people will say, look at the cotton gin and look at everything that's been made. Technology will always show us the way. And juxtaposed against that are people that say, I wish we were all Luddites and we could just live off the land again. And is there a middle way? Is that what, do you think that the take, one of the takeaways is that there is a middle way?
I absolutely think Atwood is pushing us that direction. She, in fact, another quote that she's is often reused in interviews and in writing about Atwood is that, I'm paraphrasing, one person's utopia is another person's dystopia. So technology for one person might be dystopia, and for another person it may be utopia. She says it's a matter of perspective. Dystopia contains within itself a little utopia, and vice versa. And so with the God's Gardeners, for example, in Atwood's book, some of them use mushrooms too much. They stay too fallow. They're depressed, and they're taking, you know, they're eating mushrooms to try to take the, some of their depression off, but some of them...
When you say mushrooms, you mean hallucinogenic mushrooms.
They no? have hallucinogenic mushrooms, but they have all kinds of mushrooms, and they understand how they work. So she's drawing from science there. But what we see with that book is that the God's Gardeners are not all good, just
right.
like the core people are not all bad.
Right.
And I think one of the, this goes back to the concept of speculative fiction, one of the ways this emerges in her book and in Mendel's is in the ending of the novels. If you're reading a romance, you're reading a fantasy, you want a happy
ending.
It's
going to turn out well.
that's what you hope. But,
yes.
But these writers don't give you that. They give you an ending that you have to decide about.
That's very interesting because, for example, in the movie World War Z, where Brad Pitt is fighting the zombie hordes, at the end they do find some sort of cure for the zombie-ishness, and presumably everybody will ultimately be either defeated or cured. And in fact, life isn't like that at all.
Well, at the end of both these novels, spoiler alert, but you know, you're not going to know how you're going to interpret it. Both of these novels end with light. And in Mandel Station 11, it is the people who've been living in the airport terminal, and they're up on the control tower, and they're looking out, and they see electrical lights in the distance. Now, what we don't know is that the last little glimmer of technological civilization that's about to go out?
Or the birth,
exactly. Exactly.
Well, that's very interesting because I've had people on here on STEM Spots talking about GMOs, for example, and... amazingly enough to people who are completely anti-GMO, the people who are pro-GMO are not motivated to hurt everyone. So much of the time, corporations or anybody else, at the heart of it, they think they're helping. And then sometimes things run amok, except in the case of this person who releases the pathogen because he's upset. But most of the time, that's not what happens. Things are being done because everybody thinks they're working towards their own ideal, and then all hell breaks loose.
Yeah, and in the case of this pathogen being released, what happens in the society as a result is it just brings to the foreground the problems that were already there but that were more latent. And so those divisions in society and so forth are brought to the forefront.
You know, one of the things that bothers me, and I presume you're talking to your students about this, is the exact same kinds of problems that you're faced with, for example, with climate change. So I've had people come on and talk about climate change several times, and climate change deniers, I think, are flying in the face of fact, but the solutions are scary because in one case the solutions are solar and wind, but if you know enough about energy density and other things, those are difficult to take completely over. And so one of the solutions could be retooled nuclear power. And so on one hand, you would have a retooled nuclear power, which presumably does away with some of the naughtiness of nuclear fighting climate change. And so now you're presented with some sort of Pandora's box or whatever it is that you other Greek analogy, whereby you have a solution and the solution could be a problem too. And yet in policymakers, you very rarely hear anybody at the national level have nuance in the discussion. Everything's either our way or the other way, and there is no middle ground. Same thing with AI. With AI, nobody talks about the middle ground. It's either it's going to solve every problem known to man and none of us will have to work anymore, or it's going to cause the complete overthrow of everyone and the robots will make us their slaves.
Mm-hmm.
So when you talk to your students, do you talk about how you can use this to gain insight into your own life?
Definitely. And what you're talking about is that binary or that dichotomy between utopia the perfect place that really doesn't exist, and dystopia, that horrific place that where nobody wants to be. And as Atwood says, one person's utopia is the other person's dystopia. So yes, we talk about that and look and talk about how speculative fiction asks us to look for the opening, that possibility for a third way or a middle ground.
Just out of curiosity, because I find that students are as thoughtful as they've always been. I've been doing this for 35 years, and yet it seems like they're more poorly informed than you would think in this age of all the information. Do you find them responsive to thinking about these sorts of things?
Students are absolutely responsive to thinking about utopian and dystopian literature and culture and fantasy and sci-fi. I feel like they're more open to it now than they ever have been in my teaching. I do think that we have more of an oral culture and a visual culture and less of a text-based culture. I think everybody knows that. And that definitely has an impact on the students who are in English departments assigned books to read.
Right. Well, fascinating stuff, and I appreciate so much you stopping by. Thanks, Etta.
Thank you for having me here.
And once again, this is David Cornelison for the web version of STEM Spots, signing off.
STEM Spots is available online at ksmu.org.